Hello everyone, and a very warm welcome back to Footprints. It's August, and this month we're heading out into the countryside to find out about the many traditional and ancient skills using only hand tools and age-old techniques, including scything, hedge laying, and dry stone walling. We'll learn new words such as snath and peening anvils, splashers and pleachers, batters and heartings, and not to mention the cocks and hens. Over the last decades, there's been an enormous revival in learning and using these skills to manage the land in a more sensitive and sustainable way, and maybe to see whether we can provide a viable alternative to the mechanised practices that have come to dominate our countryside. We're going to start off with hedge laying. Now, according to the Tree Council, Britain's hedgerows stretch over 700,000 kilometres. That's 1.5 times the distance to the moon. But in the last 75 years, the UK has lost 50% of its hedgerows. Hedgerows define our countryside, and though they're designed to keep stock within a field, they're also vitally important for wildlife, as a refuge, a source of food, and as corridors along which they can move through the landscape. I met up with hedge laying expert Mike Reed, who was leading a course at Bar City Farm, and I started by asking him to tell me what hedge laying is all about.
I started about 20 years ago, and it was very much about creating a stock-proof barrier. That's why hedge laying developed. It was to make the hedges stock-proof so that sheep or cattle couldn't push through if there were gaps in the hedge. But now it has really changed why we're doing it. And I would say the main focus is more about the ecology, it's more about creating habitat. And everyone's seen hedges that have been cut consistently at the same height, or maybe they've been neglected and they've grown into a line of semi-trees. And you get big gaps developing at the bottom of the hedge. And that's not great as a wildlife corridor. We need to recreate and boost that habitat at the bottom of the hedge. Everybody knows the hedgehogs are endangered. And if we have that habitat, we're going to have invertebrate, we're going to have mice. That's going to help barn owls, tawny owls. Everything's interrelated. So, yeah, I see it really important what we're doing. And that's what's great. We're doing that in an urban setting today as well.
Talking of which, here are the urbanites, the little baby ones. Yes, so hedges, they keep stock out of the next door fields, but they're also habitats for wildlife to live amongst. So they need to have Do you use a variety of plants, trees?
I mean, generally, when we're laying a hedge, if there's more variety in there, then you're going to have an older hedge. But sometimes that is deceptive. Today, the hedge we're working on was probably planted about 12 years ago, and that's going to be what we call a countryside mix. It's going to be predominantly hawthorn mixed in with black thorn, guelder rose, maybe some hazel in there, some wild roses, field maple, a real selection. So only this week we planted 180 metres of new hedge on a farm. They go in at about 6 trees per metre.
So that's quite densely planted then, isn't it? Six trees in a metre.
Yeah, very much. That's a requirement. The farmer was getting a grant, and it is a requirement from Natural England that they are planted at that density. And also we'll go back and check that if any have died, we'll replace them. And ideally, maybe in about 12 years' time, those trees could be laid to make a really dense hedge at the base. So quite often we're restoring an old neglected hedge line that hasn't been touched maybe for 20, 30 years. It's become very derelict. There's a lot of bramble in there. There are gaps in the hedge. That's quite a big part of our job. But also sometimes it might be a newly planted hedge like today, 12 years ago, and we're thickening that up and turning it into a really good wildlife corridor.
And you mentioned Natural England and the grants, and in the farming episode we had recently, we heard about the new stewardship funds. Do you think we're going to see a lot more hedges put back into the countryside?
Yeah, I think so. I think very much so. Where we've been working, one of the farm workers actually grubbed out a hedge in the 1980s, paid for by government grants. He's now seen that hedge go back in. And it was really nice. You know, he was saying, I didn't think it was right at the time. So we're definitely putting a lot back in. In fact, I mean, it's changed so much that compared to 10 years ago, I've got to get my orders in early now for hedging whips because they sell out. There are so many people now really planting hedges. The Woodland Trust are offering hedgerow packs for people at a subsidised rate. There are a lot of schemes which are really helping our local area. For example, we've got Chew Valley plant trees where volunteers go out and plant trees. Avon, these trees, they're planting woodlands and also putting in hedgerows, volunteers going out. I'm also working and doing a lot of training with the Campaign to Protect the Rural England, have a Hedgerow Heroes project as well. They have local Hedgerow Heroes project managers, and there are volunteers planting, laying hedges in urban areas, parks, neglected areas. Yeah, it's tremendous. There's a real swell of enthusiasm. I think it's quite an exciting time, really, a time we really need it.
Brilliant. So I think what we do now then is go and see the hedge that you're going to be teaching people how to lay all day.
Okay. Yeah, we were here last year, so the eight people coming today, they're going to see a section of the hedge we laid last year, so it'll be they can see what they're aiming for.
Okay, brilliant. Let's go. Sheep and pigs. Right, we're walking down a steep field just beyond the animals and the city farm, just above the football ground, glinting in the sun below us, to a hedge.
We all have regional styles. Our regional style is the North Somerset style. I was brought up on a farm in Devon, so that's a different style down in Devon, and there's a Midland style. And if you go to the national competition, the annual competition, you'll see about 14 or 15 regional styles. And we're all very proud of those, and we keep that tradition going.
So what makes it North Somerset style, Mike?
The stakes go in about a metre apart, either side staggered. And it's laid to about 3.5-4 feet high, 1.5 to 2 feet wide. And you can see that when we've laid the trees in, they're at about a 35-40 degree angle. So that's really what the North Somerset style is.
Looks very neat.
Yeah, no, it's great. And I mean, the benefit is once the tree's laid over, we can see the growth down there. The hazel grows and regenerates new shoots from where we've cut it, the actual stall. And then as the tree goes over, we call that in our local parlance a splasher or a pleacher. There are dormant buds along the trunk, and those are activated when it goes over. It's almost like when you tie your roses down. And new growth, you can see there's new growth coming up. So not only is it creating that thick barrier, but also you're getting new growth coming from the base and from the trunks along. So it's really thickening up what's there. It'll take 2 or 3 years to really get going. But if it's trimmed, it will thicken up more. And you can see along the hedge line as well, we've left some standard trees to grow on as nice trees.
And what are all the red stems in there?
Well, that's a mixture. That's fresh dogwood coming up.
Oh.
Yeah, so if we look at, you know, what we can see, I can just see there we've got some hazel, there's some fawn, there's a hawthorn at the front, there's a little bit of blackthorn in there. The red stems are, as I said, some dogwood, there's some rose in there, and it's a real good mix of hedgerow trees.
So you're going to lay this?
Yeah, this section is, which is absolutely great.
So how do you do that? You cut them, presumably? Them a little bit?
Yeah, we'll do them. I mean, basically, the tools of the trade are very simple. It's an axe and a bill hook. When we work commercially, we do use a chainsaw because we need a crack on. But traditionally, it always would have been just done with an axe and a bill hook. And it's quite important to learn to do it with the hand tools because there's a difference how trees react when you lay them. You're partially cutting through the stem, and each type of species will react differently. Some are quite tough, others, like spindle, very brittle, and you have to be very careful. They can just come off and shear away very easily. So hazel is quite easy to lay, and elm, field maple, can be quite tricky. You've got to be careful. So yeah, by doing it by hand and learning in the old traditional way with an axe, with a bill hook, you're learning and getting a feel for how the wood really varies when you how you work with it. And you don't get that if you're using power tools. You're one step removed from feeling how that wood reacts. And yeah, that takes a while to build up that knowledge, but yeah, they'll have a good go today. With all the prunings that come out, traditionally they used to be pushed up into a big bonfire. We've been looking, in fact last summer we drove up to Wales and we invested in a biochar kiln. So we're turning a lot of the waste material that comes out of the hedge into biochar. It's not like charcoal, it's produced in a different way. But the great advantage of biochar is it can go back into the soil. It looks like very small charcoal. It goes back into the soil and it locks the carbon back in the soil for millennia. It improves drainage, it improves soil structure, but nutrients also lock onto it. So we've on Monday and Tuesday this week, we've just finished working for the National Trust on Glastonbury Tor. And we're down there for 2 days producing biochar from some of the hedge laying brash, the waste that we've cut out. And that biochar is going to be donated to 2 community gardens in Glastonbury. They'll use that. They activate it by mixing it in with the compost. And after a couple of months, that can go onto the vegetable or the flower beds. And as I say, that rather than that carbon just being released into the atmosphere, that's going back into the soil. It's something which I think should be looked at on a bigger scale, you know, particularly when we're laying hundreds and hundreds of metres maybe of hedge.
Thanks so much to Mike Reed there. And if you'd like to get involved with a local group planting trees or hedges, we've put details in the show notes. Now let's move into the meadows and discover the ancient craft of scything. Scythes are once again being used in public parks, gardens, wildlife reserves, stately homes, allotments and meadows throughout these islands. And to get a lesson in scything and to find out how it's used in one of the areas of Bath, I headed up to meet one of the friends of Lincoln Hill Fields, Maurice Tennenhouse. They look after 10 acres of land just the other side of Beechencliff School. And today you've got an army of volunteers who are raking and scything. So we're going to have a little lesson in scything in a minute with Maestro Scyther Dave. But just tell me a little bit more about Lincoln Hill Fields and the friends of.
Okay, the friends are mostly locals. And what we're dedicated to doing is to increase the biodiversity of the fields. And what we're trying to do is reduce the fertility of the soil so that we can enhance wildflowers. The field that we're actually cutting at the moment is the one that is least susceptible to having wildflowers. And it was the site that the horses that used to occupy this land used to use as a latrine.
Oh, really? So it's been well manured, which is not good, I understand, for meadows.
No, it's not. And it's not because wildflowers don't like well manured ground. It's that grass and the other stuff likes it even better. So they tend to bully out the wildflowers. So the only real solution is to cut regularly. And we will be cutting twice this year. And what we're trying to do is reduce the fertility over a long-term period. But it's most probably going to be 10, maybe 15 years before we really, really affect the level of fertility. The other problem we've got is climate change has now made a lot of this grass very, very vigorous. We've had rain for months and months and months. And the weather's been warm, so the growth has been almost continuous.
I've noticed just walking in the fields how much, you know, the the amount of ragwort, the amount of wild garlic, the amount of sweet meadow sweet has just been enormous this year.
Yes, the ragwort, which some people think is a problem, isn't a problem for us because we're not using this for stock, so it's not poisonous to humans, not that anybody would eat it, and it attracts lots of moths, so it's actually very welcome. But there has been a huge amount of that, and also oxeye daisy. We're seeing oxeye daisy where we've never seen it before, and I think again it's the mild winters and the amount of water that's come down, so things that like mild wet conditions have flourished.
So what we're going to do in a minute is we're going to go over and see Dave, and we're going to learn how to scythe with a hand scythe. Tell me where you would use that.
What we're trying to do is we're trying to match techniques to the grass and the foliage that we're dealing with. So quite often the scythe mower isn't up to dealing with really, really thick stuff. So we start off with using the hand scythe, follow up with the scythe mower, and then follow up with the rotary mower. And after that, we will start raking again in the winter so that we're opening up the sward. And after that, we'll use a tiller, which will open up the sward even further. And that's when we start sowing things like hay rattle, or yellow rattle as it's known.
So, Maurice, what's your background? Is it farming?
I don't have any background in farming whatsoever. I used to be a school teacher, but the land became available because the previous tenant was asked to leave, and I live literally across the road, and I saw a sign that said land to let, and I've always loved this land, and I got together with a number of other people and said, well, we could manage this as a nature reserve in effect, and the council very kindly agreed.
Dave, you're the designated maestro scyther, and here you are with three scythes, actually, looking very beautiful. They're quite long and beautiful curved blades.
We got two different types of scythe here at the moment. The wooden ones you can see in front of you are Austrian scythes, and these have got 75 centimetre blades fitted, which is a grass mowing, meadow mowing blade, a long blade. The other one is, again, an Austrian make. We purchased this one primarily because the handles can be adjusted to some extremes. So we've got some very small stature people who get involved, and they need the handles a lot lower than they're able to achieve with the other setup. That's a metal tubular snath. The handle is called the snath, by the way. Again, with scything, there's a lot of terminology involved. You can use scythes for numerous things, really. We're using them here mainly to clear a lot of the heavy-duty stuff that the power mower, you can hear, struggles with. It struggles when it gets to really thick, dense grass, whereas with a scythe, you can handle most things. When you're looking on the internet, when you see the guys there showing off their skills, you'll see them mainly on prepared meadows, which we're hoping to get to eventually, where the grass is a lot kinder and more even and easier to cut. So you'll see them cutting through that at great speed. Plus, the terrain can be different as well. In Austria, in Switzerland, and in the Scandinavian countries, they use scythes on really steep mountainsides almost, on meadows that are really steep. And if again, you can see that on the internet, which is quite interesting. And you can use scythes through where there's a lot of obstacles, such as boulders or trees and so on, without risk of damaging them. Carefully mow around these things. So it's a very versatile tool.
And it's one that's been used for centuries.
Oh, yeah. I mean, up until mechanisation, obviously, in the 1800s, you know, 19th century, before that, everything would have been hand-scythed, and there would be gangs of scything teams that would go around the country at the haymaking time to cut the big meadows, because, you know, you effectively need quite a lot of people. I think a person can do about an acre a day. So if you've got a 10-acre field, you're going to need 10 people to do that in a day, and then you have to do it in a weather window, haymaking. You know, you're looking to cut the grass when the weather's good so you can dry it and then get it away, stored for winter. So they need to go through the meadow fairly quickly. And different regions had different techniques, different scythes as well. And there's an English scythe, which is a much more curved snath. The long handle is much more curved, with the grips fitted more directly to it. And then there's other things you have to take into consideration, such as the angle of the blade to the snath to give you the cutting angle. And then you've got the tilt on the blade as well. One of the key things is to have this blade sharp enough to be able to cut effectively.
Can I just feel it? Oh, it's quite sharp, isn't it? That feels sharp to me.
It's not quite razor sharp yet. There's two things you need to do with sharpening. One is just honing, which is using a whetstone. We've got one behind us here. It's used with water as a lubricant and take away the residue of any metal or stone that gets removed when you're doing the honing. And you're basically rubbing the stone across the blade at the angle to create the cutting edge, both front and back. But what you will find is over time, you'll need to do this more and more. Effectively, you start to round off the end and you diminish the sharp angle you need to cut the grass. So in order to restore that, you have to do a thing called peening.
Peening? I've not heard that word before.
Effectively, you need an anvil and a hammer. And what you're doing is reprofiling, you're cold working the metal. So anybody who's listening who knows about metallurgy will know that when you strike a blade with steel against steel, effectively, you're going to deform it and you're also going to change the crystalline structure. You do some work hardening of the blade. About 5 hours of mowing, you would need to do re-peen the blade.
So I guess those gangs of scythers you were talking about before mechanisations, they would have all had their own scythes, they would have known how to... They'd have been very, very skilled at sharpening their blades.
Exactly, yeah. They'd have their own whetstone with them at all times, and they would be basically continuously honing the blade as they went. And then they'd also set up a peening station where they'd have somebody full-time, basically, sat at the edge of the field with the anvil and a hammer and basically peening the blades. They'd change a blade over to a new blade that had just been peened and then get on with the mowing.
What do they do the rest of the year?
Well, I guess they would have gone on to doing hedge laying in winter. You know, the same sort of skills involved, coppicing. They would have moved on to doing that sort of task. I imagine they were also working on farms generally as well, you know, farm workers. So a farmer wouldn't really have a big gang of people that were able to do the scything in a big hit like that. It's a bit like today, tractors in combine harvesters aren't owned necessarily by one farm. They're shared, aren't they, across many farms because of the cost of the equipment. So it's very much similar to that.
So before you give me a lesson in scything, just tell me about yourself. What brought you to learn this skill?
From this project, we've had a number of spin-offs. One's been an interest in countryside skills, old ways of doing things. And I think the scythe is one of those where it appeals because it's silent. It gives you a hands-on experience where you're totally involved in the process. You get exercise out of it as well, so that's a good thing. So rather than just walking behind the mower, you're actually swinging the scythe and physically involved with the process. It's very much a hands-on business. And then to see skilled scythers at work, I went to the Green Scythe Fair this summer, which is held down by Taunton, and was lucky enough to see 10 scythers working in unison together, cutting one field.
Okay, let's have a little lesson then. How are we going to do this?
Okay, well, one of the first thing we need to do is we need to size the scythe, so it needs to be set up to your height and your arm length. And then what we need to do first of all is move the bottom handle. So I'm just going to get a spanner I have here to adjust it. This handle here has to be in line with your hip joint, basically. So if you can tell me where that is. The next thing I need you to do, please, is put your elbow on the lower handle and then you need your fingertips to be in line with the top. So it's depending on your arm length. So this handle's going to have to move up.
Okay, handles are on.
You really want to stay upright. And if you find yourself bending over as you scythe, it's probably because you haven't moved your feet. And you should be just watching what's happening with the blade. So the blade should be in your view all the time. So there's no... Although it looks extremely dangerous to have a long blade like this flying around, the blade should always be on or very, very close to the floor, so it should never be up in the air. And you're basically creating an arc as you swing. So you're starting with the blade behind you to the right, and then you're swinging across to the left. Your right hand is guiding and keeping the heel of the blade to the ground, and then your left hand is effectively pulling the snaff across, the blade across.
All right, so I'm going to have a go now. You can hold the recorder.
Okay. Well, you've cut some grass there.
Oh, look.
I can see immediately you're starting to get a feel for it, aren't you? I can see that.
I think I am, because if you point, as you said, the blade down, you definitely get a bite on the grass, don't you?
It's one of these things that you need to experience it, don't you? And you need to try it a little bit to really start understanding how it's working. And
what's brilliant is I'm giving you a lesson in holding the microphone at the same time as you're giving me a lesson in holding the scythe.
Yeah, you're doing really well, actually, I think, for someone who's just this moment picked up a scythe. And it's quite a soothing action in a way, isn't it?
It's quite mesmerising, isn't it? I can imagine if you were doing it all day, you'd have meditated quite a lot by the end.
It depends how fast you're scything. If you're really trying to get through a meadow in one day, I suspect they were trying to really push themselves a little bit.
But in that, they wouldn't have been chatting, would they? They'd have been working hard.
Exactly right. And it looks quite physical, but in fact, because you're doing a lot of the work from your core, effectively, I don't find it as tiring as it looks. I don't know where you agree with that, just having a little bit.
I don't feel tired at all, no.
That's brilliant.
Right, let me have another great. Go.
Okay.
Oh, there's another.
Another couple of meters,
there's another whole heap, hasn't there?
Yeah, well done. Done quite a lot already. That's brilliant. Okay.
Oh, I don't think I'd manage an acre in a day.
Nor would I. No, I wouldn't.
Oh, thanks so much. I'm going to leave you to carry on with this because I think you'll get it done a lot more quickly. But
that's brilliant. Thank you very much.
That's really good to meet you all.
And thanks for coming talking to us. It's been interesting. Thanks a lot.
Let's finish off now up at Lansdowne Cemetery, where the Cotswold Wardens, led by Rob Morley, are building a dry stone wall. The roots of dry stone walling in the British Isles lie as far back as the Iron Age, but most dry stone walls we see today are a legacy from the movement towards the enclosure of common farming and grazing land as English society moved away from feudalism. Let's find out how a dry stone wall is built from one of the oldest dry stone wallers around Bath, Robin Oldland. But first, Rob Morley shows me around the wall the Cotswold Warden team previously rebuilt. So this wall to the left of us
is on the main road.
Which is on the main road, yeah. Is what, over 6 foot high? I mean, that's a significant wall, isn't it?
200 metres.
And tell me what's on top. What are they called?
Well, they're called cocks and hens, vertical stones, providing weight to try and hold the rest of the stones together, really, because it's all about gravity and friction at the end of the day. So, yeah, so we've been recently rebuilding this wall along here, along the main road. And then when we finish that, we said we'd go over and rebuild the one over the other side. So that's what we're working on now.
So that's what we're going to go and look at now, the back of the cemetery wall.
Yeah.
Where you get the most amazing view over west and south to the Mendips.
Before we started work, you couldn't see the view because the wall was covered with trees and scrub and vegetation on either side. So the first thing we did is have the wall cleared.
Big gates.
So if you look now, you can see that tumbled down, broken down wall. This is what it normally looks like when we start the job.
So it's sort of wavy, isn't it? Some of it's gone completely,
cracked,
and some of it's collapsed
in a number of places.
So what's your first job then when you come across a wall like this?
The first thing, we cleared all the vegetation so we could get to it. The second thing is we take it down methodically, take the stone down, lay it on the ground in lines so we could see it. Because if you lay it in lines, then you want to choose a new stone. You can see it. If you pile it up, the stone you want is then at the bottom or something. So then we put lines up to mark the root of the wall, and then we start putting the footing stones down, which is the large ones, and then we start building the wall from there. We pick up face stones, which are the ones at the front and the back, and we fill it in with small stones, and then layer after layer, build it up till we get to the top. And then we slowly go along the wall. So,
well, you've picked a fantastic spot to do the wall. I mean, you've got the view, haven't you?
Yeah, that's one of the pleasures of dry stone walling. You often do it in a place that's nice. You have a nice view, you're out in the countryside, fresh air. So it's all the nice things about being in the countryside with a sense of achievement thrown in, really.
How much will you do today of that section's what, about, I don't know?
Well, with that many people, we might do 20 feet, I suppose. Although it doesn't all suddenly go up. We're slowly building up over a longer length, really. So it's 90 metres long, this wall, and we're probably about a third. Down to there is about a third, so we're not doing bad. We've been out 2 or 3 months. So.
And you're a dry stone waller, but you're doing this on behalf of the Cotswold Wardens, is that right?
That's right, yeah, the Cotswold Wardens, yeah. Cotswold Wardens dry stone walling team.
So who's the most experienced in the team?
Robin, who's sat down there. He's just over 90 and been doing it since about 2003, I think.
Oh, we're definitely going to chat to him.
What he doesn't know about walling is really not worth knowing.
Oh, hello, Robin. Hello. Fantastic. Nice to meet you.
Nice to meet you too.
So how did you get into this dry stone walling lark?
Accidentally, because when I came to Bath, I retired in 2003 and moved to Bath from the United States. And I was introduced to the Cotswold Wardens. The first day I got there, there were these clipboards around, spread around, with the work parties, with the jobs for the following day. And I picked up the first one, and it said, Cocks and Hens Party. And I thought, am I doing the right thing? I don't remember what the other said. I was so taken aback by the whole thing. So the following day, sure enough, in Winsley, we arrived in a field, and so there was a lorry load of new stone that had been delivered, and we spent the whole morning putting these, what I now call top stones, or coping stones, along this the perimeter of the field. The farmer had produced the stone, and so we spent the morning doing that, and so I carried on going to the work parties, and then after a while, we started a group just doing walling, and that was all that time ago, and they're still doing it. Now we're something like 25, I think, is it? Are we, John, what are we? Are we 25? 25, and I'm the only surviving one of that particular group.
Do you always use local stone to the actual, where the wall is, or do you get stone?
It's everywhere you go in the country, you get stone walls built with a local stone because that's available. It just gets dug up.
And would that be Bath stone here?
Yes, it's limestone. Yes, it's Bath limestone.
Do you have to shape the stone and cut it or do anything like that?
To some extent, yes, we do. You try and pick the stone that suits a particular space, because you can see looking at it, it's all very irregular, you see. So you never know quite what's going to fit where. That's part of the skill that you acquire over a period of time, that you know. It's quite satisfying, because you can see you start with nothing, and you have to build in sort of solid foundations first of all, and then fill the middle with what's called heartings, which is the small stone which provides the rigidity for the whole thing, and then we leave it like that, and it lasts for 100 years. Traditionally, the walls, all the farmers had walls to divide their farms to keep in this area in particular, because they were keeping the sheep in. And so in the winter, when there were not many other jobs, the farm workers, farm hands, did all the sort of maintenance jobs, among which were the dry stone walls. They did the repairs to the dry stone walls. But of course, farmers don't have help now. They don't have that sort of availability. So as you go around the area, you could see that they're in pretty bad shape and they don't need them. They just put up some barbed wire or something, or a fence. But that's how it started. That we're just carrying on that tradition.
What do you love about dry stone walling?
I think it's the variety of it. It's something that is always a challenge. It's always something different. I suppose it's like doing jigsaw puzzles in a way.
It does look like a puzzle, doesn't
it,
to me?
Yes, it is a puzzle. And some of us are better at it than others, you know.
Well, you're not going to run out of walls to rebuild, are you?
No, there's no shortage of walls.
So am I imagining things, or does the wall slightly lean in at the top?
I'm glad you spotted that, because that's how it's supposed to be. It's supposed to have a batter to it. It's called a batter, so it's wider at the bottom and gradually thinner. And the Cotswold wall is a specific dimension, you know.
And if I leant against it, would it still stay upright?
We'll try.
I can't bear the thought of knocking it over.
It's stop proof. Yeah.
It's stop proof?
Yeah.
Okay, I'm going to lean against it. Oh, yeah, it is strong.
A ton of stone and metre. A ton of stone and metre.
Yeah, we can certainly do that. I'm just trying to break a stone up. Yeah. Every now and then you have to modify a stone.
You probably already heard this, but a wall swallows stone. I mean, you think you've got enough stone, but actually a vast quantity of stone has to go into the middle of it. I always think it's a good sermon, you know, because when you look at a wall, you look at the outside and you look at the smart stones on the outside and you think, oh, that's the most important stones in the wall. But what is really important in the wall are the little stones that go in the middle. They're the ones that give it all the structural integrity, that hold it together and make it really solid. Not the big flashy ones on the outside.
Nobody sees them.
Nobody sees them.
Well, except you guys, you see them.
Yeah.
They're called the heartings. Do we know where that word comes from?
They're the heart of the wall.
They're the heart of the wall. They're what makes the wall work.
Of course they are.
Just like your heart.
Oh, look, if you look at this stone, it fits around that one, along there, up over there, right up there, look. It's as if it was designed to go there, and I've just found this stone to fill that gap.
Has that made your day, Rob?
It has, yeah. If you get that stone to match three or four others exactly, then it makes the wall stronger and it looks nice when it's finished, doesn't it?
Jeremy. What? Would I like to hear a little dulcet tone?
Oh, no.
Yeah.
Can we?
We'll drink a drink a drink to Lily the pink, the pink, the pink, the saviour of the human race. For she invented a medicinal compound, most efficacious in every case. Mr. Freers had sticking out ears, and it made him awful shy.
Thanks so much to Jeremy for singing for us, and to Rob Morley and Robin Oldland for explaining the ancient art of dry stone walling. Details of all our interviewees can be found in the show notes. Well, that's it for this episode of Footprints. Thank you for joining me. Don't forget, you can listen to all the previous episodes anytime you like. And please share as widely as you can with friends, family and colleagues. And for more information on Bathscape, visit the website bathscape.co.uk. Thanks too to the National Lottery Heritage Fund and Players of the National Lottery for supporting our work. Footprints was hosted and produced by me, Pommy Harmer, and I'll see you next month.